America has 2.2 million people in prison. If just 1% is wrong, that's 22,000 people. That's a lot of people's lives destroyed.
If the system want to take you out of society, they will do it. No matter what laws they have to break, saying that they are enforcing the laws, but they're breaking the law.
Having to hear those people say that I was guilty of a crime that I did not commit, and then hear my family break down behind me and not be able to do anything about it, I can't describe the crushing weight that was.
I'm not anti-police, I'm just anti-corruption.
A lot of times we look and we see something happen to somebody, and that's the first thing we say, that could never happen to me, but it can.
This is Wrongful Conviction.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Today's episode is one of a kind because I have two people here who are truly one of a kind, both individually and together.
Their story begins in 1984 when Jennifer was a college student in North Carolina. A man broke into her apartment.
Even as she was being raped, Jennifer summoned the strength to study her attacker. She tried to memorize his face, his eyes, his hair.
Jennifer eventually escaped, eventually made her way to the police, where she used that image burned in her mind for an artist to create this sketch. That guy she says she was 100% sure about was Ronald Cotton.
Ronald Cotton was 22 years old and worked at a seafood restaurant near Jennifer's home.
Ronald went to trial. Jennifer again ID'd him in court. It took a jury 4 hours to convict him, and a judge sentenced him to life. 11 years went by. Cotton maintained his innocence.
Scientists were able to isolate a tiny fragment of sperm that they could test. The results confirmed what he had been saying all along. The DNA did not match. On June 30th, 1995, Ronald Cotton walked out of the Alamance County Courthouse a free man.
Without further ado, Ronald Cotton, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here today.
And with him is Jennifer Thompson. Welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you, Jason.
Let's go back to the beginning. First of all, we're talking about North Carolina. And Jennifer, is that where you grew up?
Yes. I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, but the crime happened in Burlington, North Carolina, when I was a college student.
And, of course, it's a crime that Ronald was wrongfully convicted of. But at the time, it seemed like an open and shut case. And that's one of the things that makes this story so important. Again, let's go back to that time. You were a 22-year-old girl becoming a woman. You sort of had the the world at your feet, so to speak, right? And everything to look forward to until one horrible night.
Yes.
And can you tell us about that night and how this all started?
Sure. I had gone to bed on July 28th, 1984, alone. I had had a headache that evening. So my boyfriend that I was dating at the time, we were talking about getting married, took me home. I went to sleep around 9 o'clock and didn't really hear anything that was going on in the community. There was police kind of circling the neighborhood. They were looking for someone who had attempted to break into a neighbor's house. We know now that they couldn't find him because he was hiding out in my apartment. So around 3 a.m. on July 29th, I heard a noise in the bedroom, like feet moving across the carpet. Of course, I lived alone. And as I kind of woke up in that in-between place of being awake and asleep, I saw the top of a person's head beside my mattress. And I quickly, you know, asked, who was that? Who's there? And a man jumped up on my bed. I screamed. He covered my mouth with a gloved hand and put a knife to the left side of my throat and told me to shut up. He was going to kill me.
It's literally a horror movie. Like this is.
Oh, yeah. It's a horror movie. There's several things going on, right? I mean, you're trying to figure out what's happening. It's that place where you're wondering if this is a dream or this is really happening. And then you realize that you are in terrible danger. Like, I knew that he was going to rape me. That was very clear. But what you don't know, no survivor ever knows, is was he going to kill me? And I honestly believe that I'd probably not live, that he would slit my throat, that he would, you know, beat me. And you start wondering in those moments, how quickly will I be able to die? And will I feel it as I'm dying? Will it be painful? Will it just be quick and over with? And you start thinking about your parents. You start thinking about your future. You start thinking about the things that you're going to miss and you know, the things you wish you had said. And that was what was happening in that, you know, that moment when you realize that this could be the last thing that ever touches your skin.
That cliche about your whole life flashing before your eyes. It's really true, isn't it?
It's really true. It's really true.
And I know you've spoken about how you, at that moment, you made a commitment to do everything you could, not only to survive, but to memorize every detail of your assailant, your attacker, your torturer, so that you could identify him. I mean, that's some very amazingly sort of clear thinking at a time of utmost terror.
Right.
You were a clear-eyed college student. You weren't high or stoned. You hadn't been out drinking that night. You were perfect for this particular task that now lay in front of you when this attack finally ended. And how long did it go on for, by the way?
Well, from the beginning of when he woke me up to when I was able to escape was probably around 20 minutes. The assault lasted probably 5. And I was able to talk him off of me after part of the assault had happened because I knew that I needed to find a way to escape. But during that time when I was trying to figure out a plan, I was able to stand close to him to gauge his height, to gauge his weight, to remember his clothing. I mean, everything became important to me that night. And I'm glad you said task because that's exactly what was happening in my head. I was very task driven. I mean, A, survive, find a way to live, and B, watch him rot in hell for the rest of his life. So I was making a very concerted effort to pay attention to everything, even listening to his voice as he began to talk to me, trying to pick up any details he might, you know, kind of drop. And I could remember and getting myself into different positions of light. It was all, you know, part of that need to survive. And that task gave me that need and will to survive until I was able to escape after about 20 minutes.
You made this amazing commitment to this process, right?
Yeah.
When I think most people would have just been focused on getting out of there, right? And if this wasn't enough of a horror movie scenario, your assailant had cut the phone lines as
Correct.
Well, right?
He had cut the phone line. He had been in my apartment for hours smoking cigarettes, drinking beer out of my refrigerator. He'd stolen money out of my wallet. He'd even gone through a photo album and taken photographs of me out and actually asked permission. He said, "I hope you don't mind, but I took some of the photographs of you to keep." I mean, it was a mental, physical torture. And, you know, it was sexual assault and violence. It is a forever thing. And he changed me that night in ways that the girl was just, the girl died that night. She was gone.
You did manage to escape, obviously, and run down the road, which was a very brave thing to do, not knowing, you know, he could have come after you.
He did come after me. He chased me through the dark.
Unreal.
Mm-hmm.
But you outran him? Is that basically how it come down?
I outran him. The trick for me was I knew I had to get to light, and I knew he wouldn't come under light with me. So I found a carport that was on at a house that I didn't know who lived there. I just kind of prayed that people were there. But I knew he wouldn't come underneath that carport because if someone was home, they would see him. So that kept him away from me as I banged on the door. And, you know, fortunately, the husband and wife and the family were there. And the woman recognized me. She was a professor at the college I was attending. I didn't take any of her classes, but she had seen me on campus.
Wow.
And they let me in and basically saved my life.
Wow. What a story. I don't even have any words. Now, Ronald, let me turn to you for a second. So did you live in the same town?
I did, yes.
And in the days and weeks prior to your arrest, were you aware of this? Was this big local news?
Well, I guess it was the week before I got arrested. Me and my brother were standing on the street corner, and I laid a newspaper, local newspaper down, and in the wrapper, I pulled it out the wrapper on the front page. There was this sketch of a guy, and it described him and shown a picture of him and instruction on it that he committed a crime upon this female, and it was Jennifer. I didn't know it was Jennifer. You know, I just read the article, and I told my brother then that I don't know who the guy is, but when they get him, I said, he's through. You know, he's done. And, that following Monday, I went home from nightstand in the hotel with my girlfriend, and my mother and boyfriend told me as I approached the door that the police had been looking for me. And I went down and found out for that particular crime.
Now, prior to this nightmare unfolding in your life, mm-hmm. How was your life before that? How old were you?
I was about the same age.
22. Yeah, we were both 22.
Well, I had been working at local restaurants and, seafood places. And at the particular moment in time, I was not working. I was unemployed. I was in the process of filling that application here and there, you know, trying to become employed. But that particular time, I had been in the fast lane, running to bars. And, you know, I had quit school and I was working. I was just enjoying life in general. Once my mother boyfriend instructed me that the cops were looking for me, I had walked inside the apartment. I noticed a paper there on the television. It had names on it. So I took the paper, I read it, and instruction on it was how this individual had entered Ms. Thompson's apartment and committed this crime upon her. And I said, no, they got the wrong guy. And so my mother boyfriend said, well, you ought to go and get it straightened out. And so I walked outside and I looked across the road and I noticed my neighbor, Patricia, standing on the front porch sweeping. And I walked over and asked her, could I borrow her car to drive down to the police department and see what's going on in this matter? I said, well, I'll take my sister Tootie with me just in case they lock me up. And that way she can bring your car back. So on our way there, we buried off and went by my girlfriend Teresa's place. And she come running to the car crying. Calling Ron, the police been over here looking for you, saying that you raped this woman. And she said, I know you didn't. I said, no, I did not. I said, baby, we are getting ready to go to the police department right now and try to get this matter taken care of. She said, well, I want to ride. So we all hopped in the car and went down and pulled in the parking lot. Once I exited the car, I was approaching the police department. And I looked up, you know, about 2-3 stories high. And all the cops that was I saw looking at the window, rushed away from the window and run downstairs, they met me at the door, and out the door pops Mike Golden, and he said, I'm Detective Mike Golden. I said, yes, I heard you. I've been looking for me for a crime in the community that I didn't commit. He said, well, come on inside, let's talk about it, and you know, trying to get this thing worked out. So I went inside, and the alibi that I gave them was totally different because, you know, I parted a lot, and I wasn't keeping up with everything.
So how long after the actual crime was this taking place?
August the 1st.
3 days.
Yeah.
Oh, so short time.
Right.
August the 1st, around about 12:30. We went upstairs, and they began to ask me a question about Jennifer. You want saying that I went in this woman's apartment and committed all the acts upon her? And I said, I kept telling him, no, I did not. I said, my reason for coming down here for trying to get this matter taken care of. And then the police chief, he told me that, yeah, I took a flashlight and held it in a woman's face and raped her, which I was a second victim. It happened that night as well. And I told him, no. I said, you got me wrong. You know, I did not commit this crime. He said, yeah. He said, you think you missed the big stuff going around town screwing white women? I said, sir, you're totally wrong. I did not commit these crimes. Then they was instructed to take me in a room and lock me up, you know, photograph me, fingerprint me. And they took me down to the Adams County Jail, put me on $150,000 bail.
And there was no way you could post that?
No, I was there until due date of trial.
Actually, you didn't walk out for 11 years.
Yes.
I mean, that night you spent in a motel was the last night you spent as a free man.
Yes, it was.
Until this whole thing was finally resolved all those years later.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation.
I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating.
And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Jennifer, you had now seen his picture, seen Ron's picture in a photo array, and you had identified him. And now they had him under arrest. So you must have felt a huge sense of relief.
I did. I mean, there had been another rape immediately after mine, and we knew it was the same person. An hour later, a mile down the road, there's another woman who's assaulted, and I felt that we had a serial rapist in the community, and he needed to be removed. So, yes, I felt a huge sense of relief after I knew that he had been arrested and, of course, would be held over for probable cause, and we would go to trial, which became my next task.
How did they know that it was the same person?
It was a description of the clothing. Both of us had said that the person who had attacked us had on a navy blue shirt with three white stripes that went along his biceps. He had on khaki type pants. He had white gloves that were knit. I mean, both of us had the same exact description. And as he was running from the second rape survivor, police were being called. And he actually passed the police. So there was a police that actually got a short glimpse of the assailant. So we knew it was the same person. It was the same person who had attempted to break into the woman before me, because she had said the same thing. An arm was coming through her door. Oof. Blue shirt with white stripes, knit gloves. She just happened to be awake and called the police. So he never assaulted the first woman.
The other woman who was raped, was she involved in this process in any way? Did they show her the same photo array? And if so, did she identify Ron as well?
They did show her the same array. I mean, she was much older than me. And during her assault, he hit her and bit her and put a flashlight in her eyes and put a pillow on her face when he raped her. So she was not able to get the same kind of description and details that I was able to get. And so when she went to the photographic lineup and the physical lineup, she wasn't sure. She said that. I think it's number four, but it could be number five. And so the district attorney made the decision to not try the cases together, that they would only try my case, because basically they had a better conviction with just my identification.
Right. Again, yours was perfect, yes. Seemingly, right?
Right. I literally was called the perfect witness.
Yeah. So you're in prison. You're getting some sleep now, hopefully, by
not
for the first
really.
Time. Where were you staying, by the way, when this rapist was still on the loose?
I was staying about 3 miles off campus in a condominium complex.
But you didn't stay in your own apartment after this, did
you?
Oh,
no, I never returned, just only for my things. And, you know, again, the thing about being an assault survivor is when you're broken, like I was broken, you can't ever return to that place that you were before. And as I, you know, talk to people, your lens that you look at through the world becomes distorted, and everything you choose becomes seen through that distortion. Your place in the world is now distorted. What value do I have? You know, where do you go from here? Because who you were before is no longer an option. And it's now trying to recreate this new person, but you have no support. So people didn't want to hang out with me. My family wouldn't talk to me about it. My boyfriend said he just couldn't handle it, so he broke up with me. I mean, I literally, everything in my world was gone. And you're tasked now with trying to somehow recover. And I use that like I with a big sigh, because it is a forever recovery. It's just as long as you live, you're still in recovery.
It's hard for me to fathom how those particular people who were so close and intimate with you made exactly the wrong choice. Ron, back to you. So you are in crazy land now. Right? Because
yes.
You can't possibly understand, I imagine, why this is happening. And now all of a sudden you find yourself in the situation that you had just been discussing with your brother, right? You had just predicted your own fate, actually, right? Because you had said, whoever they get, well, that guy's going down, whatever, right?
That's right.
And now it's you. The day of the trial comes. How long had you been held by then?
About 4 months.
5 months.
Going on 4 months.
So you had been in for quite a while, and the jail, I don't know how that jail was, but we know that a lot of the jails in America are even worse and even more dangerous and scary than the maximum security prisons. Was this jail one of those?
I wasn't one of those. Just a lot of guys talking junk, and, you know, if you wanted to make a stand, you know, you took a chance, you know.
So, Jennifer, back to you. So the day of the trial comes. You're there hoping to get some closure, right?
Well, yeah. Closure is such an interesting word.
Well,
yeah. I mean, you're looking for justice is what you're looking for. And that's what I was looking for. I was looking for him to be held responsible for what he had done to not just me, but the other woman who wasn't going to be able to tell her story, and other women who could never find justice. So it was like kind of this thing I needed. I really needed it to move to the next place of my life. And
the
trial was over 2 weeks long.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long trial. I'm actually surprised it was that long. But by now, you had identified Ron in a photo array and in a lineup. And it's important to highlight the fact that he was the only person that was featured in both the photo array and the lineup.
That is correct.
Which is obviously going to have some impact on your perception, your memory.
Right. And of course, what we know now is that the perpetrator was never in any of the lineups. So
it seems like they did what they could in a very imperfect system to try to be impartial. Is that accurate?
Not really. They had thought before I went down to do the photographic lineup, they had believed that Ronald Cotton had actually committed these crimes. So during the first lineup, which was the photographic lineup and what they, you know, call six pack, and I had been given some instructions to take my time, not feel compelled to choose anyone, which was pretty modern thinking in 1984.
Right. That's what I was referring to.
Yeah. But when I picked Ronald out of the, you know, photographs, they did tell me, good job. That's who we thought it was. And of course, what we know now is that just gave my certainty, that confirmation I needed. And boy, my certainty went out the roof. Once they said that to me, Ronald Cotton, that photo became the rapist.
And we were dealing in this case with a cross-racial identification, which we know are the least reliable of all the different forms of eyewitness identification. It's been proven in every study that's ever been done just how unreliable eyewitness identification is. And we know that it goes up in cases in which either the victim or the witness is in mortal danger, which you
Absolutely.
Certainly were.
Yeah.
Of course, it triggers all sorts of chemical reactions in your brain, which in turn cause your memory to play tricks on you.
Mm-hmm.
It's odd, right? You were the perfect witness, but it was also the perfect storm
right.
because you had, or this particular case, had all of those factors, right? You had, again, the cross-racial identification problem. You had the mortal fear problem, for lack of a better.
The weapon focus.
The weapon focus, right? That's the best term for it. And so what should have been really an open and shut case was anything but. But we didn't know that at the time.
We thought we were doing things, best practices at that time in 1984.
We know now that it all went horribly wrong. And so you now had identified him in the photo array and in the lineup. You were given a positive reinforcement in both of those cases. Now the day of the trial comes, and you're asked to identify the perpetrator in the courtroom.
That's great. I mean, I was on the stand for 2 days.
Jesus.
Having to just over and over and over again talk about what had been done to me. Literally over and over again in front of my family, in front of strangers. It was really awful. And then you're the rape survivor, so the defense attorney is beginning to, you know, assassinate my character, basically blaming me for inviting my own rape because I had the audacity to go to bed that night in just my underwear. And so didn't I know that's what led people to rape women? And so there's a lot of things happening.
What are you supposed to wear, a coat of armor?
Well, that was my point. My point to the defense attorney was basically, so if I had gone to bed in a sweatsuit and he would have looked at me and said, I don't think so. It's just too much trouble. Is that what you're saying to me? And of course, it shut that down immediately. But I was so angry. I was so angry that somehow me going to bed as a 22-year-old woman and my underwear had been the cause of my own sexual assault.
Yeah, that's not...
And of course, it didn't help Ron, honestly, with the jury. The jury was really angry at the defense attorney for even suggesting that.
Of course.
So there were some things that happened that...
Must have made you feel uncomfortable too, Ron, to have that line of questioning. I mean, here's this woman that you've never met, that you don't know what happened or why you're in this situation that you're in.
Right.
You're 4 months and 5 months in jail, whatever it was. So your head's spinning around in all different directions, right? And now, you know, your own team is acting in a way that I can't imagine you would ever act. The whole situation is just wrong.
Yes.
And ultimately, you're asked to make a positive identification. And what happens?
I looked straight over at Ronald and I said, he's sitting at the defense table. That's the man who raped me. And the jury deliberated 4 hours and came back with, of course, a guilty verdict on all charges.
And what was that moment like, Ron? I mean, that had to be the worst moment of your life.
I just couldn't believe it. You know, I just shook my head. You know, I looked at my attorneys and I looked directly at the judge and the foreman and the jurors and the clerk reporter. And once the verdict was read from the jury form, I said, no, that's what I'm saying to myself. I said, they have it wrong. And so the judge asked me if I had anything to say to the court. And I said, yes. I told him that I would like to have his permission to sing a song that I had written in jail. And so I stood up and I sang the song. And as I was singing that song, you know, my attorneys, you know, they were sitting with their heads dropped, you know, as if though I put them to shame. But I didn't care anything at that particular time because I had just been found guilty for a crime I did not commit.
And you sang a song?
I did.
Can you sing it now?
Yeah, if I can remember word for word. I'll try to anyway. It was a poem written to my girlfriend, but I changed the words and wrote a gospel song out of it, and it went something like this. Decisions I can no longer make because my future's so unknown to me, and that I could no longer take. Because during the day I wonder, at night I heard with fear, call out his name so much, suddenly tears appear. Until God came in my life, until God came in my life, I was often alone, and people I really couldn't face. I just didn't know what to do. Without, I feel so out of place. How many times must I say this before you agree? There's no other God who ever loved of you. Not quite as much as Lord God. Believe me, everyone, 'cause God will change your life. And that is a fact. 'Cause I would pray both night and day until you come back to me. That's it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know all those words too. I just don't sound like that.
Oh my God, that's funny. That's beautiful. Your life is literally coming to an end.
Yes.
And then you get up and sing a damn song. Unbelievable.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation. I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now things start to get crazier because you're in prison. What steps did you take and what hope did you have?
Well, I had entered the prison system with life and 54-year prison term. Immediately, they appointed me a guidance counselor in the prison, and I went in, met him, took tests, talked with him about my being in prison and, you know, the crime that I was in there for. But he said, "We're not here for that. We're here to keep you." So, you know, I know it was a lost cause I was fighting. And so it was all upon me to do what I had to do to survive. And that was to stay in contact with my trial lawyers, which still continue to fight my case on appeal.
So you actually had a competent attorney in this case.
Yes.
You would have needed OJ's dream team, and you probably might have still gotten convicted. I don't know that there's a lawyer on this planet that could have gotten you out of this particular
case. No, I was fighting a lost cause, but, you know, it was a battlefield that I was in that I couldn't give up. You know, immediately, you know, I put myself in the school out library at the Central Prison and start filing motions from inside the prison, and which didn't do any good at all. And so one day I was on my way to the gym to work out, and I recognized this inmate being escorted inside the prison, and he looked very familiar to me. So I start thinking, I said, I done saw this guy before, you know, as I'm walking. And I went on continuing that process of working out, and I went back to my dorm that night. You know, they had him finish processing him inside the prison, and I went to him the next day. I recognized him from being outside in the recreation yard. I was playing a handball game I was in, and immediately I had someone to come and relieve me from that game, and I made an approach on him. And I asked him, where was he from? And he told me he was from Burlington, North Carolina also. And I said, well, you look like the drawing of a composite sketch of a rape that was committed in Burlington that I'm in prison for. Did you commit the crime? And immediately he told me, no, he did not.
But you just had a feeling, right?
Yes, I had a feeling, you know, because he resembled the drawing. You know, I had to cut it at the local newspaper because I had my hands from the newspaper in the county jail. And I cut it out and put it in my possession.
Now, finally, destiny sort of throws you a bone, right? Because right. This guy, if he hadn't come to your prison, you wouldn't have had any idea. Hadn't crossed paths with him at that particular time, you might not have had that same feeling, that instinct that you had, right?
That is correct.
But here he goes and he denies it. You have this instinct, this feeling. It turns out he's from the same town. He denies it. So you're basically back where you started, except that now you're under the same roof with the guy who's responsible for destroying both of your lives.
Right.
But there's nothing you can really do about it. But that all changed one day.
Yes.
As a result of a conversation that you had with another inmate, right? And can you tell us how that started? Because this is a really amazing part of the story.
Well, this guy, he began to lust after me in prison. I told him one night as I was in the shower, you know, I was washing my hair and shower curtain, I heard slide. And so I lifted up my hair because I had an afro at the time. And he was standing there lusting, you know, telling me what a beautiful body I had. And I told him, I'm not trying to hear that. You need to keep moving, you know. And he kept on. I said, well, I'm not going to want to try to fight a guy, you know, in the nude. You know, I might slip and fall on my head, you know, bump on the floor or something, get knocked out unconscious and, you know, guy do me in. So I just chilled. And the next day I was in the gym shooting pool, a guy from Greensboro named Roger. He told me, so Cotton, Kenny in the kitchen talking junk about you, you know. And I said, well, I'm tired of this stuff. I'm going to get this mess straightened out right now. So I handed him my pool stick, and I chug-a-lug up to the kitchen. He was in the pot and pan area with his back turned. When I approached, I stopped so many feet from him, and I called his name out, and he turned around. And he said, yeah. I said, look, man, you've been talking junk about me for so many months. I'm tired of it. You let my name taste like crap in your mouth. And he approached me and said, you better get out my face before I kill you. He put his hand on me, and I said, oh, you want to fight, right? I said, okay, let's go. So we walk around the corner, get off a camera, you know, and we fought, and I end up breaking his jaw and putting him down, and, you know, and they got me off of him, and he goes to segregation. And I do not, because, you know, the prison stewardess and kitchen had heard me telling this guy to leave me alone. So, you know, they got on my side. And so he went to hold for 30 days. And after 30 days, he come out. I was sitting in my dorm. I was sitting in the corner because my bunk was in a corner wall. I kept three chairs lining up along the wall. And he walked up to the window, and he said, Cotton. I said, yeah. He said, let me holler at you, man. I told him, come on in. You know, he comes in my dorm, and I told him, have a seat. He sit down, and he said, man, he said, I'm sorry to fight you. He said, you're a fighting dude. And I said, no, I'm just not going to go for that bull, you know. So he said, I apologize. He said, I just wanted to become your friend. I said, well, becoming a friend, don't approach me in that way. And he said, well, I just want to tell you that Mr. Poole told me that he committed the crime you're in prison for. And I said, well, thank you. And so he gets up and he walks off. And so later that night, I go to my locker and I pull out my legal pad and a pen, and I set up about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I wrote my lawyer, Phil Most, and I told him what had been told to me. And so a week or two went by. He wrote me back and instructed me, well, we're going to look into it, you know, but right now we got to go through the process of the appeals. And so I just went head on. And about the next week, Mr. Poole approached me. He said, because he got a job in the kitchen as well. He said, I know you got a lot of sisters, man. He said, why don't you let me write one of your sisters? I said, well, I don't normally let guys in prison write my sisters. And I said, but with you, with exception, I consider. I said, but first, what we have to do, I said, we have to take a photograph together. And I write a letter, and I send it to my sister. I said, she see what you look like. She'll write you back. If she doesn't, I don't know what to tell you. And so we took the photograph. Anyway, I didn't send that letter to my sister. I sent it to my lawyer.
He liked what he saw.
Yeah, that really got the ball kind of rolling. Well, I was transferred on through the prison, and I ended up in Mason, Tennessee. And I wrote the court of appeal from there. You know, by listening to the OJ trial, you know, I took my legal pad, started taking notes on the DNA. And when I felt I had enough evidence and information written down on my legal pad, I said, well, it's time for me to write to the court of appeals and request for this DNA test. And so once I wrote the letter and sent it out, Tiger Hunter from Raleigh, he wrote me a letter and told me that, he said, Cotton, you got a good case. Appeals court, he said, they turned it down, but we're going to continue looking at it. So he forwarded my letter to law school at UNC. And wasn't long after that, they wrote me a letter from the lawyer, and he told me, said that, Cotton, we're going to do your request and send you, and you have a DNA done. They didn't send me to do it, but they're going to have it done. Said, we'll do your DNA testing. But if the test come back stating that you committed this crime, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. What do you want us to do? I didn't hesitate for one moment. I sent a letter back out, do the test, because if it come back stating anything other than innocent or guilty, rather, that's it, because I'm an innocent man. I said, the good Lord knows, and I know in my heart that I did not commit this crime.
Jennifer, were you aware of this, any of this stuff going on at this time?
No, not at that time. And we had gone through a second trial in 1987.
Did Bobby Poole testify at that trial?
Well, in 1987, they had told me that there was this new name out there, Bobby Poole, that, you know, Ronald had been claiming that he had confessed to it. And but no, don't worry about it. We know that we have the right guy. So in the second trial, they brought Bobby Poole into the courtroom under voir dire. They had removed the jury, so the jury never knew about Bobby Poole. And of course, in the court, Bobby Poole denied it, said he had never said anything, he didn't commit the crime. And by that point, you know, 3 years had gone by, and there was no memory of Bobby Poole in my head, or the second survivor who was in the courtroom. And both of us said that we did not recognize Bobby Poole. And then we were asked again, did we see the person in the courtroom who had raped us? And we both pointed out Ronald Cotton. So you go to put your life back together again as best as you can, you know, life moves on. I had gotten married. I had gotten pregnant. I gave birth to triplets the spring of 1990. I had two little girls and a baby boy. And by, you know, 1995, my babies, I have 3 5-year-olds and I'm busy. You know, I'm a busy mama.
I'm halfway surprised you even showed up for the trial because, I mean, A, you said you were busy, and B, you were absolutely certain that the justice had already been done. Why would you even want to go back? You weren't forced to come back, were you?
No, but you want to make sure that the person that you think tried to kill you stays in prison.
All right, so you're there to
you have a vested interest in this.
So you were there not to learn anything, but to reaffirm what you already knew and to, you know, make sure that nothing went wrong and that he was ever free to prey on anybody else
absolutely,
again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, by 1995, when they came to me and said that there was this thing called post-conviction DNA testing, something I had never heard of. I knew what DNA was, but I had never heard the word exoneration or wrongful convictions. It wasn't part of my life. It wasn't part of my story.
It wasn't really part of anybody's story.
It wasn't anybody's story at that point. We're talking about 1995. But my blood from the rape kit had dissolved and disintegrated after those 11 years. And at some point, the courts would probably require me to give a new blood sample. And I said to them, I said, you know, I've got 5-year-old triplets and I'm busy and I'm a mama now and that's my job and that's what I want to do. So I went to the lab that day and I had my doctor take blood, put it in a vial, give it straight to the ADA and Mike Galdon, who now was captain of the Burlington Police Department. And I said, run the test because I can't do this anymore. And then
the shit hit the fan.
Pretty much. I mean, it was 3 months later, which in legal time, 3 months is like two seconds.
Lightning, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably not when you're in prison.
You know, some of these tests take years and years and years. And this one was 3 months. And they came, you know, to my house and told me that the DNA had completely excluded Ronald Cotton, but had been a direct hit on Bobby Poole.
You must have been floored.
It was one of the worst days of my life.
I'm getting the chills now. So when they told you this, did you immediately realize that, in fact, this was true and that you had been wrong all this time?
Well, I think what happened for me was part of my degree had been science, so I understood DNA. Like, I understood DNA in relation to human memory. I got that human memory is fallible. DNA was pretty dang spot on. I understood it. Like, I understood that Ronald was now going to be exonerated. I understood that Bobby Poole had committed all these crimes, that a mistake had been made. The best I can say is it's like the earth opened up and it swallowed me and everything became black and dark and I dissolved. I felt paralyzed. I felt like I couldn't breathe. I couldn't function. I mean, you know, I try to talk about this in terms of I could do my day-to-day things. Like, I could make a peanut butter sandwich and I could put the clothes from the washer into the dryer. But I couldn't function. And when it got quiet and I was left by myself, I just was debilitated with fear and guilt. It just suffocated me. And I stopped functioning for 2 years.
2 years?
2 years. I just couldn't, like, I didn't know what to do, right? Nobody was talking about these issues. Nobody was even talking to me about rape and what had happened to me, but they really weren't talking about wrongful convictions. And I had nobody to turn to. There was nobody for me to talk to. You know, Ronald was on the Larry King show and in People magazine, and I understood that. Like, I understood that. But there was nobody that cared about me. And not only did they not care about me, but they were blaming me.
Right, and that's a crazy phenomenon too, right?
It happens to all of our crime survivors. We get blamed for something that should never have been our fault. Like, we're the first person harmed. There is someone to blame. It's the perpetrator. Because not only did Bobby Poole destroy my life and the second survivor, but he sat there and watched an innocent man go to prison. And he committed over two dozen other crimes that fall of 1984 and the spring of 1985 before he was ever apprehended. He raped many women, sexually assaulted them, broke into their homes, terrorized them for months. And yet somehow the media and the general public felt that it was okay to bludgeon me to a bloody pulp for something that was never my fault. Like, there's no survivor in the world that wants to get this wrong.
No.
No. No, we want the person to go to prison who committed the crimes against us or murdered our families. Nobody wants to get this wrong. I mean, it was wrong, but it wasn't my fault. It was just... Jason, for me to explain, I mean, I got death threats. People who said to me, if I find her, I will kidnap her, I will rape her, I will slit her throat from ear to ear, I will watch her die and bleed to death in a ditch.
What is that all about? I mean,
blaming me for something that was never my fault. Ron didn't even blame me for.
Well, then that's a very, very important part of the story. Obviously, I mean, the grace of this man who's sitting in front of us is impossible to exaggerate or describe accurately. And we'll get to that part of the story in a second. But yeah, it's so bizarre because now you've got to deal with the guilt of having convicted an innocent man, which I know has such a profound effect on you and still does. And also the idea that you were now in a situation where you had not done the thing that was most important to you, which was to correctly identify your assailant, which led to these terrible outcomes for all these other women. It seems like to me, like it's, everywhere you look, it's just bad.
Well, I want to make sure everybody understands that I did not convict Ronald Cotton.
No, you can't convict anybody.
Exactly. I mean, but that's something that gets narrated in a way that is not right. Like the state of North Carolina mm-hmm. indicted Ronald and pressed charges and convicted Ronald. Jennifer Thompson had no power to convict anybody. Did I pick Ronald out of a lineup? I did. And I can explain to you how those kind of things happen, how memory kind of contaminates itself over time. But there was no way for me to adequately explain what was happening to me for the exoneree and their families. An overturning of a conviction is the day they've been praying for, is that their happy ending. For a crime survivor, for a murder victim family member who thought that the system had given them justice, which is what they promised to do for a victim, and find out that the system had failed to give me justice. It had failed my family. It had failed Ronald. It had failed Ronald's family. It had failed the other women in the community. I have not come up with a word yet that can actually explain what that looks like and what that feels like for those of us that get impacted, except it is an additional nightmare. So for Ronald, he's home. He's with his family. They've supported him. They're embracing him. The community is celebrating this man who comes back to freedom, and rightly so. That's exactly what should be happening. The crime survivor should be cared for as well. And I've talked to lots of police and prosecutors in training and talking about these things, and they'll come up to me at the end and they'll say, you know, oh my God, I totally forgot about the victim in these cases. And it shocks me, because for every wrongful conviction, there's a victim.
Right. And even if that victim is someone who was killed, that there's a family of that victim.
And we are ignored and we are placed aside and our harm is not validated. And then on top of it, the media places the blame and says things such as rape survivor falsely accuses innocent man and sends him to prison not once but twice. And there's everything wrong with that sentence.
Right, as if you were doing it deliberately, right?
As if this was To Kill a Mockingbird, and yeah. I was just making up a story.
Right, and so then the most amazing part of this story, I would say, the positive part starts, right, which is Jennifer reaches out. And how did that happen?
I actually called Mike Galden at the police department and said, I am not doing well. It's been 2 years. I haven't moved forward at all. I need you to set up a private meeting because Ron was the first DNA exoneree in North Carolina. He was about 23rd, I think, in the country. Mm. So everybody was trying to find the girl. Everybody wanted to find the girl. So I asked him to set up a private meeting where journalists couldn't find us because they were all trying to find me. So they set it up at a church that was about a mile and a half from where I'd been raped 13 years before that. And he didn't know where he was going, and I didn't know where I was going, so we couldn't accidentally leak it to anybody. And I found myself at the pastor's study, and looking out the window, I see this humongous 6'4" man kind of walking towards the building. And I remember thinking, as I looked at him, because his wife was seeing him beside of him, who's my mm-hmm. height. And the first thing I thought of was, my God, he's too tall. Mm. That my attacker had never been that tall.
Now it hit you.
Now it hit me because I had that relation, right? I'm looking, I'm thinking, oh my God, he's huge. And he was 5 inches taller.
What'd you say? What did you say? What happened?
Well, my wife, she didn't want me to go in the beginning, but I had determined that I was going anyway. She said, no, you're not going. I said, yes, I am. I said, because it would be a book closed, brain closure. So, you know, after I got dressed and I looked, and my wife, she was there, and she said, well, I'm going too. So we jumped in my truck, and we pull up, and I get out, and she gets out. And we met Detective Gall and my lawyer, Tom Lambert, and Jennifer's husband was there. And so as we were getting ready to enter the room to go in to talk, Jennifer instructed that her husband stay back, and there wasn't nobody but me, my wife, and Jennifer in the room. So when I walked in the room, Jennifer sat in, just like she's sitting there with a jean outfit on, and she had a nervous expression on her face. And I walked up and I looked at her, and she looked at me, and she said, I'm sorry. She said, I don't know what to call you, Mr. Cotton, Ronald Cotton. And she said, I'm sorry, you know, and I said, I forgive you. And I hugged her, and, you know, she stood up. I hugged her. She cried. I cried. They said, grown men don't cry, but that's a lie. You know, you got a heart to have sympathy for people. You know, you're going to cry. You know, I don't care who you are. You know, you try to be hard all you want to, you know, people walk over you, you know, walk on you. And so after that, Jennifer and my wife, they stepped to the side, said the little private things that women say together, you know, to encourage each other to be strong and carry on. So then me and Jennifer, you know, after we went outside to leave the premises, but before that, we exchanged phone numbers, and, you know, that way we can stay in contact with one another as time went by. And it was just like a good story coming to an end, and, you know, but we continued to stay in touch. Then this book deal come about, you know, I went on to be on Larry King Live and all those shows, you know, and People Magazine. But I didn't let it blow my head up because my head is already big enough. You see how it is. I just went on with my life, and she went on with her, you know. But so it was one thing after another. You know, I met a kid and all, and she met my daughter after she become into this world. And it's just been an amazing thing, you know, to know that this book has been written and is out and come together, and it's been blossoming year after year. You know, it's been over 30 years now, and they still talking about picking cotton, and I believe I pick it every day, you know, on my clothes.
I do want to get your perspective and your memories of that most incredible moment. I think it's a very brave thing that you did in a lot of ways. So what was that moment like for you?
I went in thinking that probably the best case scenario out of this meeting is going to be Ronald looking at me going, okay, thanks for saying that. You know, I don't wish you any harm, but just go away. Like, that was going to be the best scenario. The worst was going to be, yeah, him screaming at me and wishing me death and destruction and terrible things. What I didn't expect was what happened. And that was, you know, really looking at him sincerely, and I was sobbing, telling him that if I spent the rest of my life telling you how sorry I am, can you ever forgive me? And Ronald literally took my hands and started to cry. And He said, I'm not angry at you. I forgave you years ago, and Bobby Poole did this to both of us, and we were both victims of this man. And it was really that foundation that we were able to love each other. And we spent the next 2 hours asking each other questions, I think, that we had wanted to ask each other all those 11 years. Mm-hmm. You know, why did you think it was me? And, you know, my question was, well, then if you weren't there, then where were you? You know, that type of thing, like trying to peel back the layers of the truth. And he really, truly gave me back pieces of myself that I had lost. And for the first time in 13 years, there were parts of my spirit, my soul, my heart that kind of found a way back. And, you know, by watching Ronald and his just incredible love, my next task was to find a way to let go of what Bobby Poole had done to me all those years ago. And, you know, find a way to take my power back. And where do I want to give my power? And it sure as heck wasn't going to be to Bobby Poole.
So Bobby died in prison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 3 years later, after he was exonerated.
Yeah.
Was he killed or what happened?
I had cancer. Yeah. I wanted to kill him, though. I made me a weapon, and I was going to do it, you know, until my father paid me a visit, and I told him what my intentions were. And my father said, son, he said, don't do that. He said, you tell me you're an innocent man. I believe you're innocent. He said, but if you kill him, he said, you're going to be guilty. Well, and so I walked away thinking of that for 2 weeks. You know, this guy, he slept in the same dormitory that I slept in, maybe from here to over there, you know, the next room. And he walked by my bunk every day, 2 and 3 times a day, or maybe more, and worked in the same kitchen. And, you know, it was hard for me not to do it, but I'm glad I didn't do it, you know. But you know, I said a prayer to the good Lord for me to forgive Jennifer for making a costly mistake on my life. That's how I was able to face her without saying any bad things toward her. You know, I wanted to give her love, strength, and lift her up in the world, you know, because, you know, she had been down just like myself. See, I was down during time. She was down in heart and in pain. I just had to put one foot in front of the other and keep on walking and, you know, not be sad, but just continue living my life as I am today. But my life today is more in freedom and crime free.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing thing. I never get tired of hearing these stories. It puts a lot of gratitude in my attitude, so thank you for that. I wanted to talk about compensation because it's a very bizarre system that we have in America because it varies wildly from state to state. And in your case, you were given $10,000 a year, which is the North Carolina statute, for your 11 years in prison, $110,000.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I felt bad about it in the beginning, but I had to accept it. I you know, I could have fought for it, but it wouldn't have done any good. You know, they already had their mind made up. I accepted, and I walked away. You know, it's like they give me a little bit and pat me on the shoulder and say, you know, enjoy life.
Jason, it's important to note, though, that when he got compensated, the laws hadn't been changed for 50 years, so he was actually eligible for $500 a year with a cap of $5,000.
Yeah.
So Mike Galden and I lobbied the legislature to change that to $10,000 a year, and we thought we'd done this amazing thing. And then North Carolina changed it again in the early 2000s to $50,000 a year with a cap of $750,000, but they wouldn't make it retroactive to Ron.
Wow. I never understand that. So, Jennifer, tell me about the work you've been doing with Healing Justice, because it's, from what I've read, it seems like an extraordinary mission, and it looks like it's making a real change.
Yeah, we launched Healing Justice 3 years ago because I became frustrated at why we weren't addressing this long-term damage done to everybody that gets harmed by a wrongful conviction. I would listen to crime survivors. I'd listen to family members of exonerees and the exonerees, and I would hear the stories about what they had lost. And you keep thinking, right, that Pennsylvania is going to step up and fix the problems they created with exonerees in Pennsylvania, and they weren't doing it. So I launched Healing Justice in 2015, and what we do is really look at the total harm done in a wrongful conviction and who gets impacted by it, and finding ways that we can address that harm in a myriad of ways. But probably the cornerstone program we do is we host healing retreats 4 times a year, and we bring together about 25 exonerees and their family members and crime survivors for a weekend. We pay for all of it. We fly them in, and we do healing circles. We have art. We address the harm, not the cases. We literally have people kind of unfold the grief, sitting in a safe space with people who get it. Because unless you've traveled a road like Ron and I have traveled, you can't understand it. And so being in space with people who understand it, you don't have to explain why you feel depression, why you've had substance abuse issues, why you have family problems. Like, we understand it. So it's really a way of looking at the concentric circles of harm when the system fails. So the other thing we do is training for police and prosecutors about how do we address the aftermath of exonerations. You know, we're not an innocence project. We really work on the aftermath, bringing folks together after the harm's been done. How do we heal from that place? Using restorative justice principles, using peer support. It's very unique in its kind because everything we do is driven by those who have lived it. So all of our expertise is being given to us by folks that have been impacted and harmed.
And how do people get involved? How do they support?
It's www.healingjusticeproject.org. We really need the financial support to continue kind of expanding our work and bringing in more people. You know, we've got 2,200 wrongful convictions. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. We're excited about it.
All right. So I'm going to give, and I'm going to ask everybody else to do the same. And then we have a tradition here at Wrongful Conviction. I like to turn the mic over to you for any closing thoughts. Ron, we're going to save you for last. Jennifer, the mic is yours.
I really want people to understand that when a wrongful conviction happens, at the center of all of it is a perpetrator. And when we don't get it right, we've left the perpetrator on the streets to commit further harm, something that I refer to as wrongful liberty. And everybody needs to care about that. Everybody needs to know that when a wrongful conviction happens, the system has failed every single person except the perpetrator. And he is the only person who wins.
Ron?
Well, when someone tells you that they are innocent, have that open ear and open eye to reach out and touch and love very much. Because just putting one foot in front of the other, you can't walk your way out. You have to work your way out. It's easier said than done. But I've learned my lesson because I've been there. I know how it is. I keep my head to the sky every day because I'm not ashamed from where I've been, yet not knowing where I'm going. I'm on a road that I'm leading in the hands of the good Lord because He knows best. And I will not follow the rest. Thank you.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC, We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.